Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We have a stack of papers today that, I'll be honest, looked a little intimidating at first glance. Lots of Greek letters, lots of charts. But then I saw the name of the subject matter, perlite.
It sounds lovely, doesn't it? Like something you'd find in a jewelry box or an oyster.
Exactly. I was picturing a gem. But we aren't talking about necklaces today. We are talking about the backbone of the modern world.
Yeah.
If you drove over a bridge to get to work, or if you're listening to this in a skyscraper, you are trusting your life to perlite.
That is no exaggeration. It's one of the fundamental microstructures of steel. But you're right, it's not a gem, it's a composite. And today, we aren't just identifying it, we're doing something a bit harder. We are looking at a technical analysis of the kinetics of perlite transformation, specifically Chapter 8.
And kinetics is the key word there.
It is.
Because usually when we look at metal, we think of it as done. You know, it's a solid block, it's static. But the mission of this deep dive is to understand the movement, the dance.
Right. Looking at a micrograph of steel is like looking at a photograph of a crime scene. It's frozen in time. But the process that got it there, the kinetics, is a high-speed, chaotic, atomic choreography. It's a construction site where billions of atoms are rushing around trying to find a new home before the concrete sets.
I love that image. It makes the metal feel alive.
Yeah.
So let's set the stage. We are at the microscopic level. The steel is hot, it's cooling down, and it's trying to change from one thing, austenite, into this perlite structure. But the source material, specifically referencing a researcher named Berger, says there are two very different ways a material can transform.
Yes. Berger's distinction is absolutely crucial here. He categorized transformations into displacive and reconstructive, and they are worlds apart.
Okay, let's break those down. The displacive one. The way I read it, it sounded surprisingly orderly, like a military drill.
That is the perfect analogy. Imagine you have 1,000 soldiers standing in a perfect square grid. They are the atoms. Suddenly, the commander yells, "Shift!" And every single soldier takes one step to the right and one small step forward, all at the exact same instant.
So the shape of the whole formation changes. It leans.
Exactly. It shears. The macroscopic shape changes. But, and this is the key, the soldiers didn't actually travel anywhere. Soldier A is still standing next to Soldier B. The neighbors remain neighbors.
Okay, so that's displacive. It's a shuffle.
Right, and that gives us structures like martensite or bainite. It creates mechanical twins. It physically tilts the surface of the steel. It's a shape change.
But perlite. Perlite is the second type, reconstructive. And judging by the name, I assume the military discipline goes out the window.
Completely. If displacive is a synchronized shuffle, reconstructive transformation is a demolition crew followed by a team of masons. You are literally tearing down the old building, the austenite crystal structure, atom by atom. You are breaking the bonds, and then those atoms have to migrate. They have to flow through the solid metal to build a completely new structure from scratch.
That sounds incredibly energy intensive and slow.
It is. That's why the text describes perlite formation as sluggish. In the military shuffle, atoms move a fraction of a nanometer. In a reconstructive transformation like perlite, the atoms have to diffuse. They have to swim through the lattice to find their new positions.
Sluggish is a funny word for something happening like 700 degrees Celsius, but I get it. It's the difference between leaning back in your chair and moving to a new house.
Precisely. And we actually have physical proof of this difference. The source details a really fascinating experiment involving flatness. It's figure 8.1 in the notes.
I wanted to ask about this. They polished the steel first.
Yeah.
Yes. They take a sample of austenite and polish it until it is a perfect mirror, organically flat. Then they heat it up and let it transform.
Okay, so if it turns into that military shuffle stuff, bainite?
If it transforms into bainite, that mirror finish is ruined. Because the crystal physically changed shape, remember the soldiers leaning?
Yeah.
You get these sharp upheavals. The surface tilts. You can actually see the shear.
But with perlite?
With perlite, the surface stays essentially flat.
That is wild.
You might get tiny little rumples just because the density of the new material is slightly different, but there is no shearing, no tilting.
So that proves that perlite isn't just stretching the old material. It's dissolving the old material and laying down new bricks, layer by layer, without disturbing the macroscopic shape.
It's a stealth renovation. You keep the facade, but you completely gut the interior and rebuild it.
Okay, so we've torn down the austenite. Now we have to build the perlite. But perlite isn't just one material, is it? It's a cooperative structure.
Mm. It's a composite. It's made of two distinct phases, ferrite, which is almost pure iron, and cementite, which is iron carbide. And they grow together.
And this leads to the chicken or the egg question the text raises. When this transformation kicks off, who starts it? Does the ferrite appear first, or the cementite?
It's a classic debate in metallurgy. The source says it can be either, but usually one of them will nucleate first, often at a grain boundary, the edge of the crystal.
And once that first tiny crystal forms, it sets off a chain reaction.
Exactly. Let's play this out. Let's say a tiny piece of ferrite forms first. Now, ferrite is basically pure iron. It hates carbon. It has almost zero solubility for it.
It's a picky eater.
Very. So as the ferrite grows, it acts like a snowplow. It pushes the carbon atoms away, rejecting them into the surrounding austenite.
So now the austenite right next to this new ferrite is getting super saturated with carbon.
Right. It's getting way too crowded with carbon. And what structure loves carbon?
Cementite.
Exactly. Cementite is iron carbide. It needs carbon. So that high carbon environment right next to the ferrite triggers a cementite crystal to nucleate.
And I assume cementite does the reverse.
It does. Cementite is greedy. It sucks up all the local carbon to build itself, leaving the area around it completely depleted of carbon.
Which is the perfect environment for
more of ferrite.
So it's a self-perpetuating engine. One phase creates the waste product that the other phase needs is fuel.
Symbiotic rejection is how I like to think of it. They grow together because they solve each other's problems. They handle the carbon logistics for one another.
Now, I want to touch on something that really surprised me in the reading. When I see diagrams of perlite in a textbook, it looks like a stack of playing cards. Distinct layers. Black, white, black, white.
The classic zebra stripe pattern.
Right. But the text used a word I didn't expect. Permeate.
Ah, yes. This is where the 2D diagrams mislead us. We look at a slice and see layers. But a perlite colony isn't a stack of disconnected plates.
So if I could magically dissolve the iron away, the cementite wouldn't fall apart into sheets.
No, it would look like a giant branching root system or a coral reef. It's all one continuous interconnected crystal branching through the material. The phases permeate the colony.
That blows my mind. It's a single skeleton.
It is. And that 3D connectivity is crucial because it helps the growth. It means the carbon can flow along this continuous highway.
And that structure determines how fast these colonies are born, the nucleation rate. The text mentions Fisher's model.
Fisher's model helps us quantify the birth rate of these colonies. It shows that nucleation on a particle increases with the square of time. It accelerates.
Meaning once it starts, it really gets going.
It snowballs.
There's also a note about hyper-eutectoid steels, the ones with really high carbon content. The text says they nucleate way faster than low-carbon steels. Why is that?
That comes down to energy. High carbon means the austenite is very unstable. It's incredibly uncomfortable. There is a huge driving force to transform.
It really wants to change.
It's desperate to change. Think of it like a ball at the top of a hill. High carbon is a very steep, tall hill. The ball rolls down fast. Low carbon is a gentle slope.
Speaking of energy and rolling down hills, we need to talk about the cost of construction. Because as you said, nature doesn't give you a free lunch.
Never. To create perlite, you have to create interfaces. You have to build that wall between the ferrite and the cementite.
The text calls these interfaces defects, which sounds bad.
In a thermodynamic sense, a defect just means not perfect. An interface is a disruption in the perfect crystal lattice. It takes energy to maintain that disruption. It stores energy. So every time the steel builds a new layer of cementite, it has to pay an energy tax to create that boundary.
And this leads us to one of the coolest concepts in this chapter.
Yeah.
The critical spacing, Ketz works.
It sounds like a sci-fi term, doesn't it? We are approaching critical spacing, but it's a hard physical limit.
How does it work?
Imagine you have a certain amount of fuel. That's your free energy from the cooling process. You have to spend that fuel to build the walls, the interfaces.
Okay, so I have a budget.
You have a budget. The critical spacing is the minimum possible distance between the layers where all of your budget is used up just to build the walls.
So if you tried to make the layers any thinner than that,
you'd go bankrupt. There would be zero energy left to drive the growth. The reaction would literally stop. It's physically impossible to grow perlite finer than the critical spacing.
This connects to why the text was sort of roasting those neural network models for predicting spacing.
Yeah, the author wasn't a fan.
It seemed like the author was saying, why are you using a black box AI to guess the spacing when we have the laws of physics?
Exactly. The text advocates for the thermodynamic approach, equation 8.4. It basically states that the spacing is inversely proportional to the driving force.
Let's unpack inversely proportional.
It means high driving force leads to small spacing. Low driving force leads to large spacing.
So if I cool the steel really rapidly, Or if I have that high carbon content, I have a huge driving force.
You have a big budget.
So the steel says, hey, I'm rich. I can afford to build tons of walls.
Correct. So it builds very fine layers, lots of interfaces. And that makes for very strong steel.
But if I cool it slowly,
the driving force is low. The budget is tight. The steel says, I can't afford all these walls, so it spaces them out. You get coarse perlite.
It's amazing that simple economics applies to atoms.
It's universal. Physics is just the economics of energy.
Now, we've been talking about standard steel, but Chapter 8 takes a detour into something a bit grittier. Cast iron.
Ah, yes, the plot twist. When graphite enters the mix.
The text specifically mentions a 17th century cannon, which I thought was a fantastic example to ground this.
It's a great example because it shows what happens when you break the rules. In gray cast iron, you have so much carbon and silicon that the carbon doesn't just want to be cementite. It wants to form flakes of pure graphite.
And graphite behaves differently, doesn't it?
Very differently. Graphite is chemically stubborn. It doesn't dissolve things like manganese or copper. But more importantly, graphite is the final form of carbon stability.
What do you mean by final form?
Well, we've been talking about cementite, that iron carbide in the perlite. Cementite is what we call metastable. It's stable enough for most things, but it's not the most stable form. Graphite is.
So the cementite is living on borrowed time.
In a way, if you give it enough energy, it will give up. If you heat that 17th century cannon up, say, you temper it above 600 degrees Celsius.
That perlite falls apart.
It rots. The cementite within the perlite breaks down. The carbon atoms detach and say, hey, I'd rather go live with that graphite flake over there. It's more stable. So they migrate.
Leaving behind just the iron.
Exactly. The carbon leaves the perlite layers and piles onto the graphite. You end up with these graphite nodules, or flakes, encased in a thick layer of pure ferrite.
The text called this a bullseye structure.
Yes, specifically in spheroidal cast iron.
Mm.
Under a microscope, it looks exactly like a target. A black pupil of graphite surrounded by a white iris of ferrite.
It's basically the steel decomposing into a more relaxed state.
A lower energy state.
Yeah.
Always chasing that lower energy. That is the fundamental drive of the universe.
We're coming into the final stretch of the deep dive, and we have to talk about speed again. But this time, about a specific rule-breaking concept. The Hultgren extrapolation.
It sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel, the Hultgren extrapolation.
It does. But it actually explains a loophole in the phase diagram.
It does. Normally, in a textbook, we say perlite forms at a very specific composition, the eutectoid point. If you are off that point, you should get other stuff first.
But in reality, we see fully perlitic structures in steels that shouldn't have them.
Right. Hultgren realized that if you go below the equilibrium temperature, if you subcool the steel, the lines on the phase diagram effectively extend. There is a magic zone where the austenite is supersaturated for both ferrite and cementite at the same time.
So even though the overall mix isn't perfect, the conditions allow both parts of the perlite to keep growing until they consume everything.
Exactly. It removes the bottleneck. It allows the transformation to run to completion, even in off-spec steel. It explains why we see perlite so often in the real world.
Speaking of bottlenecks, the text emphasizes one hard limit on growth speed.
Diffusion. It always comes back to diffusion.
The carbon has to move.
Ferrite pushes it away. Cementite pulls it in. The growth rate of the colony is strictly determined by how fast that carbon can travel from point A to point B.
And it has two paths,
yeah,
right?
It can go through the volume of the austenite, JV dollar, swimming through the crowd, or it can travel along the interface itself, running along the wall.
Which brings us to the big debate, the decision of the material. This was the most philosophical part of the text for me.
It's the part that keeps metallurgists up at night.
We know the steel can grow. We know the spacing can vary based on the budget.
Mm.
But how does the steel decide exactly how wide to make those layers? There's a range of possibilities, but it picks one.
This is a debate that has been going on since the mid-20th century. We have two main competing hypotheses.
In the red corner, we have Zener.
Zener proposed that the system is trying to maximize speed, the maximum growth rate hypothesis. Basically, the steel wants to transform as fast as possible.
The need for speed theory.
Exactly. Zener's math suggests that to go as fast as possible, the steel will adopt a spacing of 2 times the critical spacing, $2 times SiC2.
But in the blue corner,
we have the entropy argument. This hypothesis says, no, nature doesn't care about speed. Nature cares about chaos, entropy. The steel will adopt the spacing that maximizes the rate of entropy production.
And that math gives a different answer.
It creates a wider spacing, 3 times the critical spacing, $3 times SIC2.
So Zener says go fast, and Entropy says make a mess.
Effectively, yes.
So who wins?
Well, we have to look at the experiments, and the frustrating, beautiful thing is, it's messy. The text concludes by admitting that all these mathematical models, Zener, Entropy, Hultgren, they're all 1D models. They assume straight lines.
But we established earlier that real perlite is a 3D coral reef.
Exactly. Real perlite has bulges. It has holes. It curves. It branches to fill space. Figure 8.15 in the text shows these irregularities.
So the organic nature of the growth overrides the perfect mathematical lines.
It does. The steel isn't sitting there with a calculator solving for Zener's equation. It's a physical system adapting to local obstacles, local concentration gradients, and space constraints. It's optimizing for the now, not the theoretical average.
So nature is roughly following the rules, but it's improvising.
It's jazz. It's structural jazz.
That is a powerful takeaway. So let's wrap this up. We've gone from the sluggish reconstruction of atoms, tearing down the austenite building to construct the perlite boat. We've seen how they permeate as a 3D colony, driven by the energy cost of their own interfaces.
We've seen how thermodynamics dictates the spacing, the driving force determines the architecture. And we've seen how high-carbon cast iron can decompose that architecture if you aren't careful with the heat.
So what does this all mean for the listener? Why should they care about Hultgren or critical spacing?
It matters because this is the fundamental basis of heat treatment. When a blacksmith quenches a blade or an engineer specifies a cooling rate for a bridge beam, they are directly manipulating these kinetics.
They are controlling the budget.
Exactly. They are manipulating the driving force to force the steel to adopt a specific spacing. Fine spacing for strength, coarse spacing for ductility. We are manipulating the atomic choreography to build the world we live in.
We are hijacking nature's tendency to find a lower energy state to suit our needs.
Or at least learning to negotiate with it. We can't break the laws of thermodynamics, but we can certainly use them to our advantage.
I want to leave everyone with one final thought to mull over. We talked about the steel deciding between maximum growth speed or maximum entropy. We treat these materials like inanimate objects.
Which they are.
Sure. But under the microscope, they follow logic so complex it mimics decision-making. If a piece of steel acts to maximize its own entropy production, is it so different from a biological system trying to survive? The line between physics and behavior gets really blurry when you look this closely.
That is a very deep rabbit hole, but a fascinating one. It reminds us that complexity is built into the universe at every scale.
That's what we do here, finding the universe in a piece of metal. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll catch you on the next one.